The Song of Solomon is indeed an amazing book because it talks about passionate love, so erratic, so sensual, so precious, and yet it is straightforward, open, and honest, and yet it is so beautiful. Nothing is crude, dirty, or barbaric. It's an amazing book. I am Stephen Medford. I'm your host this morning for this edition of Mornings for the Master, and we're going to look at Song of Solomon, chapter 4. We've slowly been going through this book, and it's indeed an amazing book, and we have seen how this couple has dated their courtship somewhat. They have just been married at the end of the last chapter, and now chapter 4 deals with their honeymoon, and it is amazing. I will go ahead and read chapter 4, and then we'll go back and take it verse by verse. So, they've been married, and this is their honeymoon night. It says, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from washing, every one of which bears twins, and none is barren among them. Your lips are like a strand of scarlet. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate. Your neck is like a tower of David, built for an armory, on which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way into the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. You are fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Armana, from the top of Sinar and Hermon, from the lion's den, from the mountains of the leopards. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love, and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Your lips, O my spouse, drip as honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna and spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh, and aloes, with all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden, and eat its pleasant fruits. I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, O friends. Drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones." So there we have chapter 4 and the first verse of chapter 5, which I think goes along with chapter 4. This is an amazing text. As I said before, because it talks about things that the world would talk about as somewhat nasty, but yet this is indeed very beautiful. We understand sexual activity was designed by God, and He desires us to enjoy it to the fullest extent. And He tells us how we can enjoy these things to the fullest extent. This is very different from the way that the world would talk about these things, showing that God delights in these beautiful things that He has made for our enjoyment. They are not to be buried in the dark. They're not to be kept hidden as if they are bad, but they are to be delighted in, as we see in this book. And He commands us to drink deeply of these things. As we start out in chapter 4, He says, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair." I think it's kind of interesting just to consider how He uses the word behold. Is it reflexive, like, "Wow, look at this," talking to Himself, "behold, wow, this is something neat"? Or is He telling her, "Listen to me, look, you are indeed fair. I don't care what you think. I don't care what the world thinks about you. In my eyes, you are lovely." As if He is trying to convince her. Because we know, I've seen studies where what men think about themselves and women think about themselves, men are more inclined to see themselves as worthy, or see themselves as they're happy with themselves more than women are. I'll put it that way. And so many women see or even stress the flaws that they have. They need reassurance that their husband is indeed pleased with them and loves the way they look and the way they feel. So His compliments are started here, and they go from general to specific and then back and forth again later. I think both compliments are necessary in the mind of your spouse. Give her general compliments. "You look nice today. You look lovely." But then tell your spouse, both men and women, I think it's important, certain things that you like about them. If you like the way they fix their hair, they'll be more inclined to fix it that way. They will have more respect for themselves if they understand certain parts about them that you like. And not just their physical appearance, but even things that they do, as I've mentioned before. If you like the way they do a certain thing, mention that. "I like it when you do this," or "I like the way you do this." You can be specific about your compliments, but it helps us have self-esteem, and it helps us want to do more for our spouse when we give them compliments, both general and specific compliments. He says, "You have dove's eyes behind your veil." I think the veil here might have just been the custom of marriage. We see this idea in Genesis 24 and verse 65 when Isaac and Rebecca first meet. She wears a veil. But we also might have an allusion to this in Genesis 29 and verse 25, when on the wedding night, Jacob is supposed to have Rachel, and instead he has Leah, and he doesn't know it. And it might be because she is wearing a veil. But it could be more of, some people have said that it's kind of like lingerie, something that makes her more desirable, more enticing. And of course, this is the wedding night, and I think we would do well to do things for our spouse that would make us more attractive. And even though this is a one-time event, the wedding night, I think it sets for us the pattern of how these things are supposed to transpire. And so we make ourselves more attractive, more alluring for our spouse, more exciting for our spouse. I think that's a good thing, and that's what she is doing here. He says, "Your eyes, or you have dove's eyes behind your veil." I refer you back to chapter 1 and verse 15. We talked about what it's like, or what it might mean, to have dove's eyes. It could be the contrast of the dark eyes against the skin that she has. It could be just the beauty of a dove, but it also could talk about a symbol of what a dove is. A symbol is often used for the dove is often used for a symbol of peace, for a symbol of love. And so it could refer to different things like that. Now, he goes on to say, your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. I don't know that I would recommend someone saying your hair looks like goat hair to their wife. But in this situation, I think it might be very erotic and very pleasant for her to hear this. I don't think he would say it if it wouldn't be. Many people talk about Syrian black goats were common in this area, and they had long, silky black hair. And you can imagine them winding down from a mountainside, maybe bouncing and flowing hair. And someone mentioned that the dirt or the ground in this area would have been a tan sand. And so you could easily picture the darker skin of this woman, maybe. She mentioned she was dark in chapter 1, and the dark hair in contrast to the tan skin. It might have been a very beautiful thought. In 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 15, we see that long hair is a glory for the woman. And so he is complimenting her hair. And it could be that she is letting down her hair, and it reminds him of flocks coming down from the mountains. I want to say here that in all these things, when he compares her to flocks and sheep and fawns, these are things that inspire him, that he thinks are beautiful. When you're driving along, you take notice of these things, and you want other people to look. How neat is this scene? And so these, I think, are things that depict beauty in his eyes, maybe even wealth, something that is valuable, but things that attract him, things that he notices, and that's what he is saying about her. So going on, verse 2, your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among them. So he says, your teeth have come up from washing. They are white. They look nice. Everyone bears twins. There's none barren or bereaved among them. So they are washed. They are clean. They are straight. They are there. She has all her teeth. And I think this shows that she takes care of herself. She takes pride in the way that she looks, which I think is a good thing for everyone to do. And many people mention that the fact that she is showing her teeth shows that she is smiling. She is happy about what's going on. Maybe even giggling at the things that he's saying. Someone mentioned, jokingly, I hope, that the wedding night, she could have been cringing. Ah, but she's smiling here. Going on, he says, verse 3, your lips are like a strand of scarlet, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like pomegranates, piece of pomegranate. So your lips are like scarlet. Some people mention the fact that back then they probably liked thin lips, whereas today people like full lips. It's been shown already that back then they liked fair skin, whereas today most people like tan skin. But this shows something that is beautiful to him. Your mouth is lovely, and your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate. Many people mention the fact that temple here could refer to cheeks as well, the side of your face. So it is reddish. She has blushing cheeks. She may have been blushing from shyness, or maybe she had put on makeup. We know they had makeup at this time. We have accounts of that in the Bible. Making herself, again, look attractive for her spouse. Verse 4. Your neck is like a tower of David, built for an armory on which hang 1,000 bucklers, or small shields, all shields of mighty men. I kind of thought it was interesting just to think about the neck. The neck shows a lot about a person. A neck shows good posture. They have a good air about them, like a tower. Could show her nobility. The fact that warriors were hanging shields, a lot of people mentioned the fact that this might show allegiance to her king. So her neck shows that she is for her king. She is lifted up. You know, when you're in a sad situation, you bow your head. If you're tired, your neck could be off to a side. If you are a servant or if you're ashamed, if you're mopey, she is not like that. In the Bible, the neck is called a stiff neck if you are stubborn. But you can imagine these different things about the neck and what the neck portrays of a person. So she is for her king, standing up straight, loyal, honorable, noble. It could be also that she is wearing jewelry. The bucklers, these little shields, hanging on this, kind of like a woman's neck with jewelry on it. It could be that. Verse 5. Your two breasts are like fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Now here, this is one of the places where I can imagine the world mentioning this and what it would say about these things. But there, again, nothing is dirty here. When you think about the comparison with twins of a gazelle, they are lovely. They are valued. They are soft. They're tender. They're delicate. They're alluring. They are delightful to see. Again, I think about driving by and everyone says, well, look, there's a deer. You know, everybody wants to see that. If you were out walking and you came upon a deer, twins of a gazelle, two fawns, you know, naturally, I think you'd want to go up to them and pet them and touch them, hold them, cuddle with them, play with them. But also, you recognize that they are skittish. You have to be gentle. You have to watch the way you approach them very easily. I think it's nice to think about things like this. It says that they feed among the lilies. In chapter 5 and verse 15, some people made this comparison, that his lips are like lilies, and so you can understand what that's talking about. In Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 19, it talks about enjoying the wife of your youth and letting her breast satisfy you at all times. I don't understand why men like breasts so much, but it is not bad. It is good that God made us this way, and he desires us to be satisfied by our wives, and the wife should understand that, as we see here in this text, as well as in Proverbs chapter 5. Seven things, many people mention seven things are highlighted here, the things that he mentions, and so it could be a way of slightly saying, seven being the perfect number, that you are altogether lovely. There is nothing in you that I don't like. I think about the country song, there ain't nothing about you that don't do something for me. That's what he is saying here. Everything he uses for comparison here, again, expresses an idea of wealth, beauty, something that brings pleasant happiness to him. And that's the way he sees her. In verse 6, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. This is the way of saying all night long he wishes to partake of her sexuality. Some see this as a direct reference to her breast. Going back to chapter 1 and verse 13, my beloved is a patch of myrrh that lies between my breasts all day. And so the mountain of myrrh here would be the mountain associated with myrrh. It might be a direct reference to her breast, but it could be just an idea of her sexuality. He wants to spend all night hidden between these mountains in a safe place, a sweet place, characterized by myrrh and frankincense, the sweetness of her love. Verse 7, generally, he says, "You are fair, my love, and there is no spot in you." Before he ever touches her with his hands, someone said he touched her with his heart. I think it's interesting, and everyone knows this, men and women are different, and they are stimulated in different ways. He is obviously excited about what he sees, and he seeks to excite her by the way he communicates his words to her, which obviously works here. It has been said that the brain is the woman's number one sexual organ, that she has to feel it in her brain. I don't know about all that. I'm definitely not an expert on these things. But this does show us something about a pattern that we should be like. He is expressing his words, and she is exciting him with the way that she looks. So this is a one-time event in this book, but I think it establishes for us a pattern of the way these things should continue. The marriage is public, but this is private. When you are in private, you can praise your wife. You can do things, obviously, here that would not be done in public. I think it's interesting that he says that she is flawless. There is no spot in you. There is nothing that he would change about her. Now, this is, may not be true in the eyes of others. It may not be true in her own eyes. She may look at herself and see that there's lots of things that she would want different about her body. But in his eyes, she is beautiful. You probably heard beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. Maybe he could point out something that society would say are flaws, but he feels like she is perfect. And I think this shows us a great picture of Christ in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 through 27. How when he presents us to the Father, he presents us without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. We are perfect, not because of the way we are, not because of our own doing, but this is the way he sees us because of his great love for us, and he cleansed us from sin. So there is nothing about her that he would change. Then verse 8, he says, "Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Sinar and Hermon, from the lion's den, from the mountains of the leopards." So he says, come. Now, this is the wedding night, so I don't know exactly what's going on here. He has already told her to come away with him in the earlier chapters, and now they are married and they are together. So a couple of things I offer to you. It could be that physically they are apart, and he's saying something like, what are you doing all the way over there? Come to me. Come be with me. Allow yourself to be with me. Or I kind of see this more likely, that it could be that they are mentally apart. And he is saying something like, turn your thoughts from your home. Turn your attention to me. Embrace life with me as my wife. Leave your home behind. Lions and leopards, you don't want to stay with them. You can leave your fears behind and you can come with me. I will protect you. I will be with you. Notice the verse starts with, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. And then he repeats, with me from Lebanon. So with me is repeated. We don't just want the woman to be around. He doesn't just want her to be in bed with him or to be a cook or a cleaner or a babysitter, but he wants her to enjoy life with him. He wants them to be together. I've talked before about 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, which talks about husbands dwelling with their wives in an understanding way. And the word to dwell with your wives in an understanding way, the word dwell there could be the idea of making a home with your wife, building a home with your wife. Togetherness. They want to do things together. Be with me. Live life together. Come with me. And then the next verse, verse 9. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. I will say that it's interesting, or it's understood, they're married now. Verse 8 and 9 is the first time in the book that he calls her spouse. You are my spouse now. But also my sister, my spouse. We might have talked about this before. Sister carries the idea of they are best friends. Not just captivated by her beauty, but by their friendship. They do things together. They are like family. Now they are family. And he says, you've ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, one glance, one piece of your jewelry. It should be obvious. It doesn't take much to arouse a man. They're easily aroused. And at this point in time, that is a good thing. Before a marriage, that is not a good thing. Lust is a sin. But here, we have her making his heart melt. He is now putty in her hands. He is wanting her so much at this time. And then he goes on praising her. Not just her physical appearance now, but listen to this. Verse 10. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse? How much better is your love than wine? How much better than wine is your love, and the scent or fragrance of your perfumes than all spices? Now, I think this verse is interesting because at the very beginning in chapter 1, I believe it's verse 2, she mentions that his love is better than wine. And now he is responding to that. Her love is fair, not just her physical appearance, but her love, the way she is responding to him, the things that she is doing that causes him to see love, which is intangible. Love itself, you can't see love, but you can see the effects of love. And he sees all that she is doing for him. And he says, wow, your love is much better than wine. And I said, it's interesting to me because chapter 1, verse 2, she says your love is better than wine. And if we compare this to Christ and the church, we love because he first loved us. 1 John chapter 4. I believe verse 19. And so we see his love and we say, wow, your love is so great. That's what the woman says first. Much better than wine. It is intoxicating to us. And that causes us to respond to his love. And when we respond to his love, he turns around and says, this is worth it. Your love now is great. Your love now is wonderful to me. Do we love Christ in that way, that he can delight in our love? How much better than wine is your love? And the scent of your perfumes and all spices. The air about us. The way we are supposed to lighten up a room. Whatever. The effects we have on people. It should make them better. We should be pleasant. Going on, verse 11. Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments are like the fragrance of Lebanon. Now, your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue. What does that mean? Obviously, she is passionately kissing him. She was involved. She was not passive. And to him, it is as sweet as honey. But I think it's interesting. He doesn't just say honey, but he also says milk. Honey, of course, is sweet, but it's also very sticky. Milk goes down very easily. And so she is going down easily for him. She is giving herself to him. Now, I want to mention here, this is the first time you read about honey and milk under her tongue. This is the first time you have a passionate kiss. It's not before marriage. And I have always taught that passionate kissing should be reserved for marriage. Lust is wrong. And to lust for someone that's not your spouse is wrong. If it can cause you to commit adultery in your heart before marriage, it can cause you to commit fornication in your heart before marriage. Don't do things that promote lust. A lot of people teach that dancing is wrong. Denominations all used to teach dancing was wrong because it promoted lust. And for the same reason, kissing like this is wrong before marriage. So it's only after marriage. And I think it's interesting that he may want to be in a hurry, but notice we've come all the way down to verse 11 in all this before he touches her and kisses her passionately. You might have heard it said, I don't remember who said it first, but it says, someone has said, women are like crock pots and men are like microwaves. He wants her. One look from her eyes is enough for him. But he takes time to get her to respond to him. Again, I think this should be a pattern, and it is here in the Bible for us to understand and to show us how to enjoy. Verse 12, a garden enclosed, my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. A garden enclosed, or the word could be understood as locked or barred, is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed. So, again, sister, best friends, he takes time. They take time together, like a sister and brother. They share their burdens. They are together with each other. They experience life together. They make it easy for each other to share their burdens. And this verse obviously teaches that she is a virgin. This is the first time, as I mentioned with the kiss, obvious it should be reserved, or this act should be reserved for marriage. I don't know that it exists, but I'm going to say that pretty much, as a general rule, no one regrets not having sex before marriage. But many people do. God's word tells us to save this for marriage. And that's exactly what this couple does. In Proverbs chapter 5 and other places in the book of Proverbs, but specifically Proverbs chapter 5 talks about warning us to enjoy the wife of our youth, our wife. Don't let your fountains be scattered abroad. Drink water from your own cistern once it is yours. That is throughout the Bible. Fornication is condemned throughout the Bible. This is for marriage. And in a sense, this is why people get married. You can share a bank account with anyone. You can be roommates with anyone. You can do all sorts of things with other people. But sexuality is for the marriage bond. I'm reminded of Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4. Marriage is honorable in all things, but the whoremonger and adulterers God will judge. Marriage is honorable in all things. Now he goes on. Verses 13 and 14 and 15, I suppose. Your plants are like an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard, spikenard with saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters and streams from Lebanon. So he is describing here your plants, orchards, pomegranates, her sexuality. Some people see this as a reference to specific parts of her body. But in general, her sexuality, her plants are like an orchard. The word orchard is the same word as paradise, a place you would go for relaxation, peace, a place that would be a great delight to you, a paradise, an extremely pleasant, peaceful place you want to go to relax and escape and be refreshed. All his senses here are overwhelmed by all these things. Spikenard, saffron, calamus, cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh, aloes, with all the chief spices. So here he is describing an exotic garden and a fantasy place. There is no place on earth, many people talk about, where all these fruits grow together. And so she is fulfilling his fantasies. She is amazing to him. A fountain of gardens, a well of living water, streams from Lebanon. Many times a woman's sexuality throughout the Bible is referred to as these streams. Again, I refer you to Proverbs chapter 5. And then for the first time, I guess I should say this, that often throughout the book, we've mentioned the woman does most of the talking throughout the book. This is the Song of Solomon, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, but it's the woman who does most of the talking. She is his song. And in this chapter, he is the main speaker. He is overwhelmed. He has to express these things. These things are amazing to him. And so in verse 16, this is the first time she speaks up. And she says, "Awake, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits." So she says, "Awake." Now, if you've been with me, where does the word awake occur in this book? And why is it significant for this place? Twice already, and we're going to see it again. She has warned us, or God has warned us, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. Don't do things that excite sexual activity until the time is right and it can be fully awakened." And now she says, "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind." Alternating winds produce the best harvests. Again, I'm not an expert on these things, but I'm told that the colder the winter is, many fruits become better in the summer when it's springtime. To have a good crop, you want to have a cold winter. And some go so far as to say the cold and the warm from the south and the north are like the way she is. Maybe playing a little hard to get when it's time and giving herself fully when it's time and so forth. The north wind being cold, the south wind being hot. Making love a little better. And some people have even compared this to the way God is. Sometimes he seems to hide his face from us. And sometimes he gives us all these blessings. In doing so, he makes life better for us. Whatever that's worth, I don't know if we can go that far in this. I do think it is significant. She says, "Come, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out." And then she says, "Let my beloved come to his garden." My body is his body. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 2 through 5 make this very obvious. It starts out talking about, because of the present distress, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. They were going to go through hard times. But for sake of fornication, for sake of temptation, you are to have your spouse. And he says there in a couple of ways, you do not have possession over your own body, but your spouse does. And so we need to understand that. And she understands that here. "Let my beloved come to his garden." Again, she is not passive. There are a lot of women who think all the man needs is for to go through the activity, and she can be passive in it, and that will fulfill him. That does not fulfill him as he needs. She is wanting this. Let the wind come and blow upon my spouses. I want him to want me greatly. And that's what happens. Very beautiful. And then the last verse we're going to talk about. He says, chapter 5, verse 1. I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Notice how often he says, my. I've come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. He has taken of her, and she is his. This is great. I read someone who said, sexual relationship is for procreation, for recreation, and for communication. This is the way the man understands love. If without this, he does not feel loved. And now he is getting this. This is what he enjoys. He says, I have done this. And it is straightforward. Again, these things are open, honest. They are beautiful. There's nothing crude here. A couple of things I think we can take from this is that intimacy is different with men and women. And we see this in this text. They are different, and God made it this way for many reasons. One of which is to typify our relationship with God. God desires us now, but he has to woo us. It could be that women are more verbal and men are more visual. That's what we see going on here, at least. But there's obviously something that is important to this. Men need to speak more. Men need to make their wives feel that they love them. And women need to show their husbands that they love them. Love is visual and then physical here. And I did not read the last part of verse 1 of chapter 5, which to me is wonderful. I believe, and many others do as well, that this is the one time God speaks directly in the book. It's like God pops in and says, eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. And it really doesn't matter who is doing the speaking directly. All of this is the word of God. But the point is, God wants us to eat and enjoy this. Drink from it deeply. Again, God is the one who made these things. God is the one who wants us to be pleased with these things, with his creation. And he delights when we do enjoy the things as he directs, as he planned, as he purposed. It is indeed a wonderful thing. And that is Song of Solomon chapter 4. Very erotic chapter in the Bible. Most people ignore the book for reasons. We don't see these things are not comfortable to speak about. But they are in the Bible, and they will bless our lives greatly. And I hope studying this, seeing this, will be a blessing to those who hear it. It can affect us whether or not we're single or married, whether we have lost a spouse, widows, widowers. We can read these things and we can be blessed by these things, whether or not we actually participate in the physical activity or not. It shows us what God has done for us, but it also, as I've said many times, typifies our relationship with God. This is the way he wants us to feel about him. He wants us to be in love. He wants us to give our lives to him. He is excited by us, and we need to be excited by him. So I hope this has been a blessing to you. I have really enjoyed studying it myself. If you would like to contact us for any reason, I always want to give you the contact information, 1-844, the word 4, TGRN, 1-844-367-8476. Or you can email us, mornings@tgrn.org, or Steven, S-T-E-V-E-N, you can email me, @tgrn.org. If we can assist you in any way, we would love to hear from you, and I do appreciate you listening.